Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have had the great pleasure in the, some 40 years, I think it is now, of being involved in one aspect or another of this war for the free world, as I call it, to have as a colleague and comrade, an inspiration, a mentor, and good friend, a man who we are going to kick the show off with today. He is Ambassador Henry F. Cooper. He is, among other things, the former director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under President George H.W. Bush. Prior to that time, we worked together when he was President Reagan's chief negotiator at the Geneva Defense and Space Talks, hence his formal title as Ambassador. He has been an extraordinarily active contributor to the public policy debate in a number of capacities, notably as chairman of High Frontier and as a senior associate of the highly regarded National Institute of Public Policy. I believe he's also been a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, chairman of Applied Research Associates, so much more. It is a great pleasure to have him with us to talk a little bit about some of the things that are occupying him these days and should be of concern to all of us as well. Ambassador Henry Cooper, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Thank you very much, Frank. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, I thought we'd start, Hank, with stocktaking a bit, I guess. The President of the United States, of course, earlier this week unveiled a new national security strategy, which, among other things, has set guidance for policies and programs in the areas that you've spent most of your professional life, including, by the way, in the Air Force, both as a military officer and as a civilian. What is your general assessment of this new strategy?
Well, I have to admit, Frank, that I haven't studied it in great detail, but I did scan it, and I was impressed by a number of things that are there and highlighted in this document, and also by President Trump in his introduction in his public address, which is somewhat rare, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of a major strategy like this being put forward, that the president would bring it out himself. I think that it's really a key that he highlighted the role of space in the future, and I'm very hopeful that when the missile defense review comes out, that we'll see some specifics on that. The devil is always in the detail, and the Department of Defense has the lead, of course, in trying to deal with the future of space and its role in missile defense in particular. And of course, I'm very interested in seeing space-based interceptors make their way back to the table for the first time in a serious way since I left the SDI program in 1993. And that's the most cost-effective way to do this job. So I'll be looking at the details that come out of DOD. The other major innovation was the mention of electromagnetic pulse, which I believe is the first time it's made its way into a national policy statement. And those items are not really disaggregated because EMP is a threat that can be provided to the United States by a high altitude explosion. And one of the earliest ways that we have to counter that is with truly effective missile defenses, which is, of course, a major concern to me.
Yeah, well, you've set a very rich table there. I want to talk you through several of those points, Ambassador Cooper. I'm pleased to say we have two segments with you, so we'll get into this in some detail. Let's start with space. You have, as I said, worked in the Pentagon, in the Air Force, of course, in the missile defense community, as well as in the contractor community for quite some time. Tell us a little bit about the history of your work on the high frontier, as our friend, the late General Danny Graham, used to call it. The importance of our ability to operate there and to exercise control of that domain, Hank, for both military, strategic, and commercial reasons.
Well, it is the high ground, and that was part of the reason for the name High Frontier in the first place when Danny pushed it. And the really neat thing was that Reagan took that on, President Reagan, and he made that the centerpiece of his strategy. Many people may remember, your older audience anyway, that there was a great renovation that happened in the early days of the Reagan administration because the Carter administration had allowed our military capabilities to atrophy, very much like what has happened most recently. And Reagan picked up the pieces and made peace through strength the key to his strategy, as President Trump is now making a key to his own.
It's a leitmotif of the new strategy that he laid out.
It is. And I hope we have as much success now as we had then, when you and I were working together on the strategic modernization program in the early days of the Reagan administration. The B-52, we used to say, was flown by, you know, the grandsons of the sons of the original pilots. Now it's the grandson.
Right, and heading towards great grandsons, I'm afraid. Yeah, no, we've been living off the modernization that you helped oversee, Hank Cooper. But on space, Hank, I guess I'm just persuaded that most of us, it's kind of like oxygen. We take it for granted that the platforms, the satellites, the capabilities that operate from space, things like the GPS and telecommunication satellites and space weather monitoring systems and so on, are all, you know, things that we just assume will always be there. If they weren't, if we were to lose control of space, if the Chinese, for example, as you know, have spent an enormous amount of money trying to both be able to put things up there and to take things out of there, if they were to be able to do that with impunity, what would the implications be for us militarily as well as economically?
They'd be catastrophic. As you mentioned, I worked in the Air Force in the days we were putting forward the GPS. And frankly, it was as much because of the civilian oversight that we got the GPS system in the first place. Regrettably, though, the GPS system is not seriously protected against the threats that we now confront. And it is the timing that goes into most of our military systems anymore. So we lose GPS, we lose the ability not only to not have to follow a map the old-fashioned way, which everybody now avoids by using its cell phone, but our military would be in dire straits as well, including those on the battlefield. So space is terribly important, and regrettably, we haven't done the things we need to do to protect our space assets, and that includes passive hardening kinds of activities that need to take place, as well as, I would say, active defenses, including, in my judgment, in space. To do that, we've got to overcome a major policy hurdle that has blocked our ability to build the necessary space systems to accomplish that end. Regrettably, you mentioned China. China has actually taken advantage of the SDI technologies that we pioneered 25, 30 years ago, and we have ignored them since 1993, when they were deliberately taken away, as Les Aspin, then Secretary of Defense, says, when he took the stars out of Star Wars. So we're behind, and we got a catch-up game to play in getting back to space. I'm frankly am very hopeful that we'll get a separate space corps, I guess is the buzzword that's now being used, like our Marine Corps as part of the Navy, but a Space Corps as part of the Air Force rather than just another organization within the Air Force. We need a dedicated space force, in my judgment.
Sounds like a great idea. I know it's been kicked around for a long time, and we have to pause here for a moment, Hank. When we come back, I want to just draw you out a little bit more on what you demonstrated is possible from space using technology that, as you say, is now two or three decades old, let alone what's available to us today. And also get into with you a bit on the president's strategies, commitment to recapitalizing our nuclear deterrent forces, something else that you're expert on, and arms control that has been a problem in that space as well as in so many other domains. Hank Cooper is our guest. We'll be right back with more with the chairman of High Frontier and a great American right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are in our second segment with Hank Cooper, former U.S. ambassador presiding over the defense and space talks during the Reagan administration. Also, the man in charge of missile defense development during the George H.W. Bush administration. And Hank, we talked earlier about this so-called brilliant pebbles idea that you pioneered and really were right at the cusp of deploying, as I recall, when, as you said, the Clinton administration came in and Les Aspin knocked the pegs out from under it. Tell us a little bit about that approach and whether it's still viable today, especially with the technology that's available now.
Well, let me go to the bottom line. Yes, it's viable, and the technologies today are several generations better prepared to deal with this than it was then. Actually, I have to say that Jim Abramson, who was the first SDI director, initiated this program as a black program out at Lawrence Livermore Laboratories. Lowell Wood, who's a brilliant scientist, was the creator of the idea. But Abe got it started. George Monahan was my predecessor, took it through the stage where it became the first approved program in the Department of Defense to enter a formal acquisition process. And I was pleased to carry it forward and embody it in a program we call Global Protection Against Limited Strikes, which emphasized the importance of brilliant pebbles in being able to intercept missiles in their boost phase and throughout all phases of flight, including the reentry into the Earth's atmosphere. And we got a long way along with that. The key element were tiny computers at the time to replace the old mainframe computers. Everybody's aware of that capability today because they carry it around in their pockets and a cell phone. So it requires no invention today. It just requires applying it. Regrettably, we killed all of the technologies in the missile defense field. In fact, I think the private sector has pursued it further. And regrettably, I already said the Chinese
are doing so aggressively. Well. Yeah. I think that the truth of the matter is when you look at what the president has described is his appreciation of the need for missile defense and his determination to have it and congressional direction now embodied in law for a robust missile defense. We're going to have space-based elements, and I hope that they will pick up where you left off and greatly improve on what was available now three decades ago. That's in part, Hank, because, as you know, this threat to our country has been metastasizing dramatically. We've been talking about the Chinese. They're in the business of nuclear threats to us. They're, of course, now strategic partners with Russia, which is aggressively modernizing its nuclear forces. Both have deployed, we believe, hypersonic and maneuvering weapons that will be very challenging for missile defense. Even the North Koreans and the Iranians are in the game to varying degrees, threatening us. To that extent, the president's national security strategy has also emphasized the importance of rebuilding our nuclear deterrent. You've devoted a lot of your professional life to that capability as well. Give us your read, Ambassador Cooper, on where our deterrent is at the moment and how important it is that we indeed undertake a very substantial rebuilding of our posture in that regard.
Well, I believe we need to have a major program in all three legs of the triad, the bombers, the ICBMs, that's the land-based missiles, as well as the submarine-based ballistic missiles that we have. They all, the ones we have deployed today, originated during the Reagan era. The B-2 and the B-1 no longer is included, I believe, in the nuclear role, in a nuclear role in our force structure. So we need to be working on all three of those. This is going to require major investments. There is no way of avoiding that fact, but we are foolish if we allow our adversaries, particularly as China is growing its capabilities and as Russia actually is modernizing its capabilities in all aspects. And as you mentioned in your introduction, some of these capabilities have advanced penetration ability as well. So we need not only defenses, but we need the ability to threaten at its heart the strategic forces of particularly Russia and China. And I hope we'll be able to deal effectively with North Korea and Iran, who unfortunately is closer to having a nuclear capability than most people credit it with.
Hank, let me ask you one question on all of this, because one of the things that I didn't like in the national security strategy, I have to say, was that in the section about missile defense, there was a genuflection in the direction of the policies that previous presidents have embraced, namely, oh yes, we're going to have a national missile defense capability, but it will not be able to protect us against Chinese or Russian missile threats. As a man who's, again, devoted your life to this field, does that make sense? And can we, in fact, afford to remain in such a posture of vulnerability towards these countries that, make no mistake, are increasing their ability to attack us with devastating effect?
Well, to link back to what we were saying about Brilliant Pebbles, the idea behind Brilliant Pebbles that I advocated in 1990, actually, in a review I did for President Bush, was to have a capability, and it involved 1,000 interceptors in space, to have better than 95% probability of being able to kill all of an attack that involved 200 reentry vehicles coming into the Earth's atmosphere. So this was no small defense, and it would clearly take care of the threat from North Korea or Iran, and in those days, certainly China, and I believe China today. In the case of Russia, Russia could overwhelm even that defense with a large number of missiles. So the main focus was on preventing an accidental or unauthorized launch of from a, say, a Russian submarine where captain controlled up to 200 missiles or so RVs. And we wanted to make sure we could kill all of them. So deterrence will continue to play a role in situations where we have a major deployment of nuclear weapons against us. I believe it's possible even to be effective against that with a cost-effective deployment. And that capability in 1988 dollars was $10 billion to build that system, including the R&D, the development, testing, deployment, and operation for 20 years. That would correspond to $20 billion today, which is a lot of money, but it's trivial as compared to what we're spending on all sorts of other things in the department.
And trivial compared to the costs of remaining exposed to all of this. And that really brings me to the last question. You know, we're looking at the danger in a way that currently we have no defense to speak of against it at all. My view has long been, Hank, that if you had a Russian targeteer that is ordered to construct an attack against the United States and can't be certain which of his missiles is going to get through, I think that can make a considerable deterrent impact on the desirability or seeming utility of such an attack. So even if you're not able to take down the whole thing, it's well worth having in place. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Alas, Ambassador Cooper, there's so much more to talk with you about. I hope we'll have a chance to do so early and often in 2018. I wish you the best for the merry Christmas season and also for a great new year, my friend, and thank you for joining us today. Next up, we'll speak with Peter Pry. We'll pick up on the point Ambassador Cooper made about electromagnetic pulse and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We are back. It is a great pleasure to say, joined by another longtime friend and colleague, comrade in arms in what I consider to be the existential challenges of our time in the continuing drama of the war for the free world. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and a man whose career over some four decades in and out of government has been exemplary of the kind of public-spiritedness and professionalism that has enabled us to get through some of the sticky wickets of the past and is going to be more needed, I'm convinced, in the future than ever. Fortunately, he is keeping his hand in at the moment as the executive director of a congressional task force on national and homeland security. He has, however, recently had to lay down his responsibilities as a staff member, in fact, the staff director of the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission. And again, we'll turn to that in a second or two. But I did want to promote several of his important books. One is Blackout Wars: State Initiatives to Achieve Preparedness Against an Electromagnetic Pulse, the subject of another, Apocalypse Unknown: The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe and Electric Armageddon. Peter Pry, it is so good to have you back, sir. Welcome, and Merry Christmas to you.
Well, Merry Christmas, Frank. Thank you for having me on your show and being a comrade in arms. You're always understating your own role in these matters. No progress would have been made had it not been for your efforts in the Center for Security Policy.
Well, that's very kind of you, and back at you, sir. Let me just say, my Christmas present, I think, this season was the passage in the Trump National Security Strategy unveiled earlier this week that we discussed a moment ago with our friend Ambassador Hank Cooper, namely the president's commitment to protect our infrastructure against, among other things, electromagnetic attack, as he calls it. You've worked, as I say, Peter, ceaselessly to try to ensure that we are protected against that. Tell us a little bit why that is so important and what it means that the president has enunciated this as a priority in his new strategy.
Well, it's the first time in any presidential national security strategy that electromagnetic attack, has been addressed. So that elevates it to the highest possible level as a focus of our national security strategy and the, bureaucracies that are supposed to look to the NSS for guidance will now have an additional reason, an enormously important reason, the views of the president himself to start protecting this country against electromagnetic attack.
And how vulnerable are we to it, and how would it be delivered, Peter?
Well, it's an existential threat. The Congressional EMP Commission, estimated that, a single nuclear weapon could black out the entire national grid for a year or more. And if we did have a year-long blackout, up to 90% of the population could die from starvation, disease, and societal collapse. This means that a failed state like North Korea, that's armed with a single nuclear weapon, could pose an existential threat to us. And we have warned that they actually do, potentially through satellites that are currently orbiting over the United States, but also from these ICBMs. One of the criticisms that Dr. Graham, who's chairman of the EMP Commission, and the commission itself has made repeatedly, is that our focus has been on the ability of North Korea to blast a city and people arguing over whether they've got a reentry vehicle or not that can penetrate the atmosphere to blast the city. when in fact the threat that's here and now is EMP. They've been able to do an EMP for quite some time because you don't need a reentry vehicle. You don't need accuracy. And they've had satellites passing over us for several years now.
Yeah. And Peter, your commission, the commission on which you serve for most of its life, actually established that the Russians or the Soviets, as they were transitioning into their reorganization under the Russian Federation, may well have provided the North Koreans with designs for not just electromagnetic pulse-capable nuclear weapons, which is basically any of them, but ones that have been optimized for that purpose. Is that right?
That's right. What the Russians call a super EMP weapon, which is specifically designed not to make a big explosion, but to produce a lot of gamma rays, which is what makes the EMP effect. You know, such weapons have very low yield, under 10 kilotons, could even be 1 to 3 kilotons, which is in the range of the first three North Korean nuclear tests. They also said that in addition to the design information for super EMP weapons being heard from Russia to North Korea, supposedly accidentally, but they also said that while it wasn't their fault, there were Russian engineers and scientists who knew how to build nuclear weapons and missiles working in North Korea, you know, because of brain drain, because the economy was bad and Kim Jong and the North Koreans had bribed them to go to North Korea to work there. And in effect, they were distancing themselves and saying that, well, that wasn't a matter of Russian government policy, but we wanted to make you aware that while it's not our fault, you know, they've got our design for a super EMP weapon, and they've got some of our best scientists working on their missile and nuclear weapon program.
This is chilling, especially when, as you and Dr. Graham have made clear, also former Director of Central Intelligence Jim Woolsey, the consequences of even a single North Korean nuclear weapon, specifically of this kind, a super EMP, could be so devastating. Peter, this would seem to be, especially against the backdrop of the priority the president is giving now to this threat vector, a moment when we should have your commission fully engaged in helping to essentially effect the kind of protection that the president is calling for. And yet the commission that was set up by the Congress to evaluate the dangers of a grid down situation has itself been stood down. What is up with that? There's I guess now language in a defense authorization bill to create a new commission, but walk us through what is happening here, the backstory, if you would.
Right. You know, the original Congressional EMP Commission has really been indispensable to our national security. You know, because it's been working the same team on and off for 17 years to develop plans and policies to protect the country from EMP.
And these were arguably the best physicists and electromagnetic pulse experts and engineers in the country who have been tirelessly putting their shoulder to this wheel. Who will replace them if there is a new commission?
That is the question. And I think you know for sure that at least 6 of the 12 new commissioners are probably not even going to believe in the EMP threat, because half of them will be appointed by Democrats. And EMP has become a political hot-button issue. When the commission was first formed, most people had never even heard of EMP. So we were able to make it a nonpartisan commission and focus on talent and get the best scientists, engineers, strategic thinkers on EMP into that commission. But now, and you can see it in the press, places like Washington Post and the New York Times, in fact, just a few days ago, there was another article published by a person on the left arguing that EMP is a science fiction threat, that it isn't real, and that the Trump administration is foolish to be concerned about it. Those are the attitudes that are reflected by, you know, liberal Democrats. And so the people that write articles like that, I'm very concerned that we'll end up with a so-called EMP commission that has half the commissioners with no real expertise in EMP, but who come out of academia and pretend to be experts, the kinds of people that write for the Washington Post and the New York Times on this as if they're experts, but they really know nothing.
and could well set back dramatically the work that you all have done, the nature of the record that you've created about the seriousness of this threat by making it a further politicized playpen for their political agenda. Peter, we have to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, an expert as well on nuclear forces and arms control. We'll get his thoughts on what's up in that space right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are visiting with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, one of the most brilliant national security practitioners I've had the pleasure of knowing and working with, who has been almost single-handedly. He's had some people holding his coat from time to time, including us and the Secure the Grid Coalition. We're proud to sponsor at the Center for Security Policy, but there are a few people besides himself and, of course, the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission, on which he has served for so long, who deserve more credit for helping raise the alarm about the threat we were discussing in the previous segment of electromagnetic pulse. Peter, I wanted to switch gears with you and come back to something I talked about with Hank earlier in the show, namely another part of the president's national security strategy, which I welcome very much as a necessary corrective to the kind of, well, I think of it as malign neglect, certainly of the past 8 years, with respect to our nuclear deterrent forces. The president has talked about recapitalizing those forces. Hank Cooper mentioned his belief that we need to modernize all three legs, as they're called, of the strategic triad, the bombers, the long-range land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, and the submarine-launched missiles. I wanted to talk to you about another piece of this. You're a scientist. You have been deeply involved in the strategic force programs, including as a member of the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission. Do we need to be modernizing as well the nuclear weapons themselves? And if so, do we have to resume nuclear testing to ensure that they work?
I don't consider myself a scientist. You know, my background, my degrees are in history and international relations, but my real education, you know, was on nuclear strategy when I worked at the CIA. And I do have a certificate in nuclear weapons design because they sent me to school at the U.S. Nuclear Weapons Lab. So I've absorbed a lot from, you know, from working in the nuclear weapons community. But yes, I think it's far more important, you know, that when we engage in modernization, you know, that we actually upgrade the technology that's in our nuclear weapons so that we can match the new nuclear weapons that the Russians have certainly built and that the Chinese have probably built. And even the North Koreans are frankly ahead of us, since they almost certainly have the super EMP weapon. We don't have anything like that in our arsenal. The Russians, we know the most about because they have written a lot in their open source writings about having what they call third generation nuclear weapons. You know, this would include things like super EMP weapons, clean nuclear weapons that are pure fusion that can be used on a battlefield, mini neutron bombs that are tuned to just create neutron radiation and would create no fallout on the battlefield. So in effect, what they've got, in addition to the classical city busting, silo busting, bunker busting kinds of weapons, they've got this generation of highly usable nuclear weapons that are much more powerful than conventional weapons, but could be used like conventional weapons on the battlefield in an aerospace. I mean, another one are nuclear weapons that are designed for producing X-rays, you know, for intercepting incoming warheads and taking out satellites in space and that sort of thing.
Tailored weapons for specific purposes. And unfortunately, Peter Pry, as you know, the Russians, the Chinese, these others surely have doctrines that call for the use of these weapons. It's not just simply something they envision as an unusable doomsday device, which is how a lot of people have thought about it in our country. Peter, let me ask you about one other piece of this, which almost always gets neglected. I think the president has alluded to it, but I want to make sure that we emphasize it as well. And that is the necessity when you're thinking about modernizing our nuclear forces. We also have to do, as a matter of the first order, urgency, the modernization of our industrial base that supports our nuclear forces. Do we not?
Absolutely. It's been allowed to wither away. Pakistan produces more nuclear plutonium and uranium than the United States does right now. We don't even have the ability to make tritium anymore. You know, the fundamentals of what we used to make, I know you have to wrap this up, but before we go, I want to go back to the doctrine part. You know, the doctrine is arguably just as important as the weapons, perhaps even more so. I like to think of the Blitzkrieg strategy that the Nazi Germany came up with in World War II. It was this doctrine, their strategy, that made them an almost unstoppable force. You know, if you looked at their individual planes and tanks and their fast-moving infantry, the British and the French had comparable technologies, but they didn't know how to put them all together in such a war-winning way. And that's the kind of gap that we've got that's, I think, the most dangerous thing. And one of the things that also gave me hope about the president's national security strategy is the way he parsed the words. He talks about cyber attack, physical sabotage, and electromagnetic attack. That's exactly what the EMP Commission has been warning about. All three of these would be used in combination in the military doctrine that we have been analyzing from Russia and North Korea and Iran.
You have to understand the enemy and anticipate their moves in order to deter, not to defeat them. Peter, just back on the testing question very quickly, recognizing that you're not a scientist, how important is it that we have the capability to establish through old-fashioned empirical underground testing that, well, for that matter, the weapons we have in our arsenal today are still functional, let alone the modern designs we would like to see integrated?
There's a great debate among that on that. One of our EMP commissioners, Dr. John Foster, who designed most of the weapons in our current deterrent, argues that our failure to test over the past 25 years really undermines, in his view, the credibility of our deterrent, you know, because there's a question about, you know, how reliable these things are. The Clinton administration struck a political deal with the labs to agree to pay them generously to implement what he calls science-based stockpile stewardship, where we would not test the nuclear weapons. This is because they wanted to get us in the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So every year, the so-called nuclear weapons labs certify that our nuclear weapons are safe and reliable. And that has been enough to convince the parties because there's this huge deference to nuclear weapons labs. But there isn't a consensus, and the best scientist I know of and our best nuclear weapons designer that I know of is very concerned about whether those weapons would actually work since they haven't been tested in so long. And we know that there's compelling evidence that the Russians cheated. They supposedly have not been testing too, but we know that they have been conducting low-level tests. Some of them could have been decoupled, and they could be of much higher yields.
Which would have been hugely critical to their successful modernization of their entire arsenal. Go ahead, Peter.
I would also point out that our labs, our so-called nuclear weapons labs, and I call them that because they have not been working on nuclear weapons for 25 years. And for a long time, there was a law called Spratt-Ferb that had been rescinded, but they still adhere to it, you know, where it was illegal for our own national nuclear weapons labs to even think about nuclear weapons of new design, the way the Chinese and the Russians and the North Koreans are developing them. And the blasts are still adhering to that.
Peter, we are hard out of time, and I had wanted to get beyond all of this to talk with you about arms control and the degree to which it seems not to be operating in terms of containing the threat from Russia, to say nothing of China, which, of course, is not party to these arms control deals with us. The nuclear weapons laboratories, I guess, are still doing bits and pieces of nuclear work, but they're not in it as they should be. But to the extent that we're about to see massive breakouts, perhaps, of arms control treaties like the New START treaty by the Russians, to say nothing of the INF treaty, we really need to be about the business of retooling, rebuilding, and modernizing our forces soup to nuts, as well as the industrial capacity to support them. I thank you, my friend, for your great work on the EMP Commission, the Strategic Posture Commission, in the Congress, at the CIA, and so much more, as well as, of course, your service with us in the Secure the Grid Coalition. I look forward to talking with you often and certainly early in 2018. In the meantime, Merry Christmas to you, Peter. Godspeed. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.